Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm your host, Stephen Dozman. Imagination is one of the most important elements of being human, but it is most often assumed we know what it is while rarely being analyzed. Here with me today is Jonathan Erickson to discuss his recent book, Imagination in the Western Psyche, From Ancient Greece to Modern Neuroscience. The book looks at various theories of imagination through history and then looks at what neuroscience can tell us about the functioning of imagination, as well as looking at the functioning of imagination and what it can tell us about neuroscience. Erickson is a writer and educator and holds a BA in English Literature from UC Berkeley and a PhD in Depth Psychology from the Pacifica Graduate Institute in California. Jonathan Erickson, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
So just kind of as an introduction, can you kind of introduce yourself to listeners and tell us what your kind of main areas of research are?
Sure. Well, as you just mentioned, my PhD is in depth psychology. There was an emphasis in somatic studies, mind-body stuff in the program. And that involved looking at a lot of neuroscience and trying to bridge what is a very qualitative field, depth psychology, with what we're learning about the body from a neuroscientific perspective and how mind and body are integrated. So it was following that course that led me to this fascination with the experience of imagination, which is very central to depth psychology, and how that lines up with what we currently know about neuroscience and the neuroscience of imagination and where the gaps are and how we might start to bring these two ways of looking at imagination together.
Yeah, that really came through really well in the book. So to begin, a lot of analytic study of imagination uses what you call kind of a propositional model, whereas you prefer one about generating meaningful images. Can you kind of unpack these two approaches to imagination and why you prefer the latter?
Yeah, well, the reason I prefer the latter is I'm just oriented towards depth psychology, and the latter is definitely a depth psychological approach. This idea of a propositional imagination is something that comes out of cognitive science. And that whole project is about looking at the brain as like a computer system and understanding the way our minds work, using the computer as a model for understanding our minds as computational systems. I'm being a little reductive in talking about that, but that's the basic idea. And so in that tradition, you'll see a lot of mental phenomenon sort of reduced to more simple processes. So in this case, for imagination, in the propositional imagination, there's a lot of focus in cognitive science on the process of a mind trying to game out what's going to happen in the future. So what happens if I go to the park? What will I see? What happens if I skip work today? What will happen to me? Those sorts of things. And so in that case, you have a proposition, something that may happen, and then trying to imagine the consequences, which is a very pragmatic, practical thing to do. And it's important to understand that mental process for sure. So I'm not putting down the study of that mental phenomenon. But I find it too reductive to totally encapsulate the phenomenon of human imagination, which is a much more rich and complex experience that we have, this ability that we have to imagine not just the outcomes of possible future choices, but to imagine ourselves as different people, to imagine different worlds, to imagine all sorts of fictions and stories that don't exist, or to envision different ways that humanity might find the way out of the various messes that we're in. It seems to me that imagination is just rich and broad and in many ways mysterious in the number of things that it makes available to us. And to take all of that and just reduce it to one aspect of itself, which is the what if question, it's just too reductive is the simple answer. And I wanted to approach this phenomenon in a way that really honored its complexity. And the complexity that that has been recognized, particularly in the humanities over the centuries, as people have tried to understand what imagination is.
Yeah, great. So in introducing us to your thinking about imagination, you give us three terms, the first two being imagination as the phenomena itself and imaginary as the thing that pertains to the imagination. But then you have a third, the imaginal. You define it as an intermediary experiential space between physical reality and mental abstraction. Can you kind of unpack this for us a little bit?
Yeah, so the problem with stopping at the word imaginary is that it has this connotation, particularly going into the 20th century, that of something being unreal. Right, that if something is imaginary, if you have an imaginary friend, well, that's not really a real thing. That's just this unreal thing that you're engaging with. It's just a fantasy. Excuse me. Whereas in depth psychology, starting with Jung, there's this idea that events that happen in the psyche are real psychic events. They are ontologically real in the sense that something is happening that we're experiencing that is meaningful to us, even though it isn't happening in the physical sense. So qualitatively different, but still ontologically real, a kind of reality, this psychic reality that we engage with whenever we're looking within and experiencing our own subjective experience, that subjectivity has a level of reality to it. You're definitely having the feeling. You're definitely imagining the story. It's just that those things aren't physically real, right? They don't exist out in the world as material events. So this idea of the imaginal is taking that idea into the realm of imagination, that if something is happening in imagination that is meaningful, we want to allow it to have some degree of psychic reality, some degree of ontological reality. And in order to do so, we have this new word, the imaginal. An imaginal experience is an experience you have engaging in the imagination, engaging with your own psyche through imagination. And by using that word instead of imaginary, we take a stand for the importance of some of these inner events that we can have. You can have a dream, for example, that's incredibly meaningful to you, or that brings a lot of insight or a new way of thinking about yourself or the world, or there's wonderful documentation of people who've had solutions to problems showing up in their dreams. Well, so what is the dream? It's not, we can debate about the physicality of what's happening in the brain on the purely physiological level, but on an experiential level, you're having an experience of this dream, of these images, of this insight coming through and engaging with you in a way that touches you or changes you or transforms you. So we call that an imaginal event, an event that is of the imagination, but has a reality all its own. Is that enough of a distinction for you? I could probably go on about it.
No, that's actually really helpful. So the approach or kind of method you employ throughout the book, you call it model agnosticism. What is that?
Yeah, model agnosticism is doesn't come from depth psychology, although it does have some parallels with Kant and with Jung and a particular worldview. And it's an idea, it's a stance that is somewhat skeptical of our ability to ever fully grasp what's going on around us completely. Rather, we as human beings in our attempts to understand the world create these models of reality as a kind of map to help us understand what's going on out there. And so a map is a great example, right? If you're engaging in new terrain, you might sketch out a preliminary map to help you understand what's out there in the landscape. Now, as Alfred Korzybski famously said, the map is not the territory, but it's useful to us to have the map if it's relatively accurate. So the idea with model agnosticism is we have all of these mental maps about what the world is, how it works, and all of those maps that we've created, all those models we've created, have a certain amount of usefulness, right? They're useful as long as they allow us to engage with the world in a meaningful and productive way. But we also have to be willing to take a step back and realize that they are just models. They're not reality itself. And sometimes our models need to be revised. And what I like about this perspective is it allows a lot of different things to be true, but just in different ways. So rather than getting into a conflict, for example, between whether a strictly cognitive neuroscience approach to the mind is quote unquote correct versus a more qualitative depth psychological approach, we can just view them as two different models of the mind that are useful in different circumstances. Right? A depth psychological approach might be much more helpful in a psychotherapeutic setting where someone is really struggling with trying to find purpose in life, whereas the cognitive neuroscience approach might be more helpful in terms of basic habit changes, for example. How do we actually get ourselves to employ different habits? So the point of employing this is to allow for more possibilities and to allow for each possibility to have its own use within a certain context without having to say that it is absolutely true in all contexts. It comes out of things that have happened in physics over the last century, where we'll have a model of light, for example. Light is a wave. This is the classic conundrum from early quantum physics. We have a model of light as a wave. We have a model of light as a particle. But the more we study light, the more we realize that actually light doesn't completely fit into one model or the other. Sometimes it fits one model, sometimes it fits the other model. So by taking a model agnostic approach, we're able to allow for these multiple models of light to understand that the phenomenon of light is something that's even more complex than the models we're employing to understand it, and yet still able to use the models in a meaningful way to help us better understand the world. So it's a way of fully engaging with a way of looking at the world and everything it has to offer us without necessarily having to then accept that this is the sole and only truth, the only way of looking.
Yeah, it's very pragmatic. So kind of moving on, you start kind of looking at how to study the brain. You give this really interesting little example. You write, 100 ants on a flat surface will wander randomly until they die, but a million ants becomes a kind of superorganism exhibiting sophisticated behaviors that the study of any individual ant could never predict. So jumping off that, you talk about the importance of having sufficiently complex models of brains to really understand them. Can you kind of unpack how complexity works or should work in neuroscience?
Well, I want to be careful of the should. I don't want to tell the neuroscientist what to do.
Avoid reductive models of brains, I guess, would be a way to put it.
Sure. I guess what I want to say is that there's a reductive approach to the brain, which is useful to a point, right? You call that a model too. We can employ a reductive model of brain science that really just wants to get down and look at the individual pieces and how they're interacting. And that's very valuable in itself, right? We learn all sorts of things. We learn about the micro architecture of the brain, and there's always valuable new information coming out of that. So I'm certainly not suggesting that that's wrong or bad or that we shouldn't do that. But there's this other thing that's happened in the last few decades, this emergence of complexity science, of complex systems, self-adapting complex systems. And the thing about the discovery of this, we're actually able to map these things out as natural phenomena. That's what's so extraordinary about it is, so for example, with the ants, we see insect colonies as a complex system where the individual ants or the individual insects, there's nothing in the individual that would ever be able to predict what the superorganism is going to do once it starts interacting with itself. So if you have just a bunch of ants wandering around, they're just going to wander around until they die. There's nothing in the individual ants that's going to be predictive of what the complex whole will do. But if you have a million ants, it's going to start to exhibit behaviors that are more than the sum of its parts, essentially. Really extraordinary. And my understanding is that we're still in a process academically and culturally of wrestling with what this means, what it means to our worldviews. So there are a number of systems that have been recognized as having what are called emergent properties like this, right? Properties where what emerges is more than the sum of its parts, essentially. Insect colonies are one, economies are another. Weather patterns are weather is considered a complex system, and the human immune system is a complex system, and the human brain and nervous system is also a complex system. So this is, I don't say this often, but this is kind of just the way it is. We have these incredibly complex brains with all of these interacting parts, and so we have these emergent properties of brains that only show up at higher levels of interaction. And no amount of just studying the neurons and the interactions of neurons and the interactions of chemicals and hormones and neurotransmitters, none of that on its own will be able to predict the global outcome of such a complex system. Now, again, it's still very important to understand how those smaller pieces work, but the mistake happens when we get so far into a reductionist mindset, which was, you know, very dominant in the 20th century. We get so far into a reductionist mindset that we think we can explain absolutely everything at this more granular level. And we've forgotten that actually all these granular pieces are going to come together in ways that, that we're probably going to be trying to understand for, you know, decades, if not centuries to come.
Yeah. So from here, you actually start a really interesting history of imagination. Kind of at the start, you follow Yuval Harari in arguing that there was a sort of cognitive revolution around 40,000 years ago. What happened here, and how did it give way to what we might recognize as something resembling imaginative potential?
So Yuval Harari has written a wonderful, very, very provocative book. He's a historian, and his book is
Sapiens, right?
Yeah. And the central premise of the book is that what set humans apart as a species, apart from many other intelligent species on this planet who exhibit, you know, the beginnings of culture and a certain kind of language and various complex behaviors, what set us apart, according to his theory, is that we started to be able to create and share fictional realities with each other. We started to be able to share fictions. And he uses a very broad understanding of fiction that can be a little challenging to some people. He includes money, for example. That's my favorite one to start with. The money is a fiction because money doesn't actually exist in the world in the sense that there is no inherent physical value, even to gold, right? We have assigned a value to gold, right? A certain amount, a certain weight of gold has a certain value, but that's only because of something that's happening inside of us. We're all agreeing to imagine that gold is more valuable than granite.
We trust it.
And for that reason, we're able to then employ this imaginary substance called money. And it's actually completely reshaped all of our lives, right? So this is another example of how something that is imaginary also certainly has reality. It just doesn't have an ultimately physical reality. It's a reality that is rooted in the mind. So he goes on about all the different things that fall into this category. And it's really most of human culture and society are things that really only exist because we agree to imagine them together. Government, for example. I mean, hierarchies, all sorts of systems that we engage with on a daily basis are there, not because they have been there in the world physically emerging from nature. They exist because we as humans have created them and agreed to believe in them together. So I think this is as I said, you know, it's provocative, and it really challenges us to think about what do we believe is real, and what do we think is important, and what are we giving meaning to both individually and as a society. It was certainly a helpful perspective to me in my own research and thinking about the role that imagination has played. The idea that we are all, to some extent, whether we know it or not, and this is something I get into towards the end of the book, we are all imagining the world together in many respects, not in all respects, but in many of them.
Yeah. So moving forward, kind of more explicit theories of imagination start to kind of be developed. You start with Plato and Aristotle on this, and they had a theory of phantasia. You connect it with other things like image making, appearance, mimesis, and coming to light. Can you kind of unpack what their thoughts of imagination were?
I can try. The Greek, there is no word for, if we go back and look at where the words come from, the word imagination comes from the Middle Ages, imaginatio. I believe we get that word from Augustine. If we go further back to the discourse on imagination, we have this Greek word, which I believe is pronounced fantasia, and you see the clear link to the English word fantasy, right? And fantasia is, its etymological roots are around appearances. And the discourse around fantasia is a discourse around the way things appear and the questions about what is real and how do we engage with the appearances of reality. So Plato, it's interesting because Plato sometimes gets he has a reputation for being against art and artists and creativity because he famously suggested in the Republic that the artists should all be cast out because they were troublemakers. And what he's getting at with that is Plato has a vision of reality in which there's this sort of divine perfect realm, right? The Platonic ideal. There are these ideal forms, and our reality is just a sort of a shadow of that divine realm. We're sort of a pale reflection of that divine realm. And so in his mind, for an artist to then make a piece of art that simply imitates the world is, it's like making a copy of a copy, right? It's a photocopy of a photocopy. It's sending attention in the wrong direction. Whereas Plato wanted us all to go within and realize this sort of internal Platonic realm of ideas. The artist, in his view, was taking us more into the mundane, this world of false appearances. And that was why he wanted the artists cast out of the Republic. He felt that it was a bad value system, kind of for spiritual reasons, more than anything else. That said, though, there are other places where Plato has a very different view of imagination, and that's where he sees imagination as actually coming from the divine, where he sees image as being a conduit from the gods, that we can receive images from the gods. And in that reception, in that connection with the divine, well, that's all great. That's beautiful. That's, you know, that's a beautiful process for Plato to use image as sort of a bridge between the mundane world and the divine world. He also said that artists were the true calling of the artist, if I understand him correctly, was that the artist was meant to express the glory of the gods and the glory of the heroes. And that as long as an artist was doing that, then there was, you know, that then there was room for them in the ideal society. So Aristotle, the rebellious pupil to Plato, had just a completely different worldview. His worldview was much more focused on the senses and on empiricism. And for this reason, he's often called the grandfather of empirical science. And for him, truth is not in this ideal realm. Truth is in the world, and we're going to find it by paying attention to what our senses tell us. And for Aristotle, then what imagination becomes is a conduit, a psychological function between the world of sensation and the world of pure intellect. Maybe world is the wrong word. He's talking about psychological capacities. So he's the one that first gives us this idea of imagination as a psychological faculty. And it's the faculty that allows us to move in between pure abstraction of our thoughts and then the gritty sensory reality of our senses. That imagination is sort of like the go-between, the messenger that allows us to make connections between those two worlds.
Yeah, so one of the other kind of origins for imagination that you pick up is actually in Hebrew culture, particularly with some of the older scriptures. And you do this really interesting reading of the story of the forbidden fruit and the tree of knowledge. And you kind of show how for them, imagination was connected with other questions of like free will and temptation. Can you kind of unpack what these scriptures tell us about imagination in their view?
Yeah, so my understanding of this is in the Hebrew tradition, which is the other deep root of the Western psyche, we have this idea of the Hebrew word is yetzer. That's the closest we get to imagination in those texts. And what yetzer is about is it has implications around action and creativity and will and choice. So there's a good yetzer and a bad yetzer, essentially. And the good yetzer, the good creative spark, is the spark that's in alignment with the divine will. So a little bit similar to Plato, but maybe with a bit more of a moralistic tone. The good yetzer has us creating in accordance with God, whereas the bad yetzer is the voice of temptation, which basically drives us to sin. And the things we create that are outside of the divine will are the path to sin and destruction. So in that tradition, the whole idea of creativity and imagination at that point feels very wrapped up in a morality of going along with God's plan or disobeying it.
Yeah, so the seeds that have kind of been planted in both Greek and Hebrew thought start to become kind of picked up and reanimated in the Middle Ages with Augustine in the Christian tradition, Jewish rabbis, Islamic imams. So how in the Middle Ages were these ideas around imagination kind of being picked up again in various ways? I know that's a big question, but...
Yeah, So the church fathers during that time were part of their scholarship was looking at the ancient Greeks, looking at the philosophy of mostly Aristotle, but Plato in some cases as well. And making sense of that either in the sense of incorporating it into their theology or making distinctions. And it's not a time where there were a lot of revolutionary new ideas about imagination emerging. Let me put it that way. There was a sense of a continuation of this idea that you could have a divine vision. It was possible, but there was a lot of concern about the idea that imagination could lead a person astray. And I don't know that it was, there wasn't as much psychological emphasis. There was more worry about things like magic, about demonic possession. This idea that, you know, there were these forces in the world that were manipulating human beings towards good or evil. And so it was certainly possible during this time to have a dream and believe that it came from God and to follow that dream or that vision. But there was also danger of committing heresy, essentially, if you saw something that, you know, you weren't supposed to see or wasn't in alignment with the church's understanding of what was true and real and good. You know, it's not really until we get to the Renaissance where that all starts to open up. And I don't know if that's your next question, is it?
Yeah, I was going to ask about, you The term was not coined in the Renaissance, but it is well known for Renaissance men kind of in retrospect or retroactively. So looking at using that term just kind of as a starting point, what kind of jumping off the skepticism towards imagination from the Middle Ages, what does the cultivation of Renaissance men and more individualistic artists and thinkers and poets, what does that kind of tell us about ideas about imagination in the Renaissance?
Well, let me just back up a little bit to bridge your last question with this one. One of the things that was happening in the Renaissance, and part of what made it such a fruitful, generative time, is that there was a new openness to some ancient texts coming in and sort of cross-pollinating texts from other cultures. So there was a resurgence of Greek myth. There was a renewed interest in Islamic viewpoints. There was this great sort of cultural moment of these different traditions coming together and an awakening of new possibilities. And that goes part and parcel with an awakening of imagination, right? As new possibilities emerge, we're suddenly imagining ourselves in new ways. We're imagining human potential in new ways. And an interesting aside, this phrase Occam's razor, which is a common trope around taking a more reductive view in the sciences, Occam, the idea of Occam's razor is the simplest solution is usually the best. Sometimes it's interpreted to mean it's always the best. Now, Occam is a Renaissance figure, and what he was actually talking about was that there were too many different religious ideas coming into the church. There was too much Greek religion essentially awakening in the church. And what he was saying is, well, we don't need all of these other deities. We don't need all these Greek gods. We don't need all these myths. We just need the one God. So he was really putting forward a kind of religious fundamentalism. It's so ironic that perspective would then become this sort of emblem of the reductive move in science. I bring that up because I think fundamentalism, you know, whether it's in religion or science, often tries to push us back towards something simple and easily understandable. Whereas in these times in history where imagination has started to open up, all of a sudden, so much more seems possible. We're imagining all these different possibilities. We're imagining all these different gods, right? Which from a depth psychological perspective is imagining so many different potentials in ourselves as personified by these gods and goddesses and these different cultural perspectives on what divinity might be. So during this time, to get to your next question, we have this idea of the dignity of man becoming very important, and the possibility of the individual really fulfilling a creative potential in a lot of different areas at once. And, you know, to some degree, you saw this back in ancient Greece too, but it was an idea that had been gone for quite a while in the Middle Ages, this idea of an individual really excelling themselves across multiple fields and growing in many different directions and becoming a really sort of well-rounded, more holistic, if you will, human being. That's obviously a more 21st century word, but I think it applies in this case. And so there was a tremendous renewal in the arts, in creative expression, in philosophy of ideas. And a lot of this just comes out of the fact that so much more was possible now because we'd broken out of the rigid structures of what was and was not allowed. And we were able to allow new possibilities to come in and inspire us and to start to imagine ourselves and the world differently.
Yeah, so kind of following along that line, but skipping ahead a little, you go to later on Nietzsche and Freud, who you talk about in terms of rationalization. What role did rationalization play in their thinking around subjectivity and imagination?
Well, so just to be clear, I don't know that Nietzsche ever talked about rationalization. I think that that comes out of...
Not as a term, but I know it comes...
Psychology.
It feels kind of in the background, like genealogy of morals. Like he's kind of thinking along similar lines,
well,
I think.
He was very interested in rationality and its limits, for sure. And that's,
right.
That's part of why I begin my chapter on depth psychology with Nietzsche. It's actually Walter Kaufmann, I think, who said that Nietzsche was the first great depth psychologist, even though we don't usually think of him as a psychologist. He actually did sometimes refer to himself as a psychologist because he was trying to diagnose the human soul. And of course, psychology comes from psyche, the Greek word for soul. So he was in that area, although we have a much more clinical perspective on what psychology is supposed to be at this point in history. Anyway, Nietzsche was the one who really passionately made the case that there's so much more going on inside of us than our high-minded rationality, that so much of our the surface of what we present to the world and our supposedly always well-measured and thoughtful and rational decision-making processes are that's the surface of a much more complex set of drives and energies within us, and that we are driven by all sorts of primal forces essentially, and that the rationality is a sort of a covering for that. This had a tremendous impact on Freud. Freud and Jung actually were both deeply influenced by Nietzsche. Freud took this idea and put it into a psychological system, essentially. And Freud was one who was actually doing work with clients, right, or patients, which is how we think of psychology today. And I actually don't recall in the moment if the idea of rationalization comes from Freud. It might. Sounds like something he would have talked about. But the idea with rationalization is that we do something for essentially a purely emotional reason, and then we come up with a rational explanation after the fact. We say, oh, of course I did this for all of these rational reasons. But actually, that's a story we're telling ourselves to make sense of the fact that we've done something that was purely emotionally driven. And it gets into this idea that we have this unconscious self, this unconscious aspect to our being. And that it is from that unconscious aspect that a great deal of our behavior actually emerges, and that consciousness is a much smaller piece of what we are. And so this is an important setup for what Jung later develops in his psychology, because Jungian psychology is all about engagement with the unconscious through images. For Jung, image was the bridge to the unconscious, and thus image was the bridge towards self-knowledge. I might be getting ahead of your questions here a little bit, so I'll pass it back to you.
Oh, yeah, no worries. Speaking of Jung, you actually connect Jung, in addition to Nietzsche and Freud, you also argue that he's picking up Kant. Kant kind of had his own Copernican revolution in epistemology, which then gets picked up and developed by Jung. So first, what was the move that Kant made, and how, for Jung, was it kind of a forebear to modern psychology in his view?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Jung made several statements along the lines of considering himself a Kantian, that he was a Kantian philosopher. He followed Kant's philosophy first and foremost. Kant is, of course, a very complex thinker who wrote volumes, so I won't try to summarize him in a couple of minutes, but the main idea here from a psychological perspective is that he's the one who, the so-called Copernican revolution in philosophy, which I believe is a term that he himself used to describe what he was suggesting.
He did, yeah.
Is that rather than us seeing the world as it is, he posited that we see the world based on the structure of our minds, that our minds are structured in a certain way, and because of the structure of our minds being that way, we perceive reality to be a certain way. and that whatever reality actually is beyond that structuring of our minds, well, that's the thing in itself, right? The noumenon, the sort of untouchable and unknowable that we can only know through this filtering process of our minds. So he talked about, for example, causality, these a priori capacities that we have, these a priori ways of engagement with the world, time, causality, and so on. And so this was it was revolutionary because it took the idea of truth in the world and said, you know what, maybe we can never actually know that in the ultimate sense. What we can know is how the human mind apprehends reality, and shift our focus to that. So this was profoundly influential to Jung in the development of his psychology. Jung was very interested, for example, in this idea of projection, the degree to which we're constantly projecting aspects of ourselves and our inner world out onto the outer world. We're making all sorts of assumptions about what's out there based on what's inside of us, which is a very Kantian framework. Perhaps more importantly, Jung's idea of archetypes, this idea that there are these foundational patterns of being, which that's what my understanding of an archetype is. It's a foundational pattern of being, or a foundational pattern of human experience, that these were another kind of a priori structure of the human psyche. These archetypal structures of what a human being can be, what a human being can experience, are deeply ingrained within us and get activated in various ways in the course of our existence, and that we experience the world through these archetypal patterns. So in some ways, Jung's psychology of archetypes was a great expansion of Kant's a priori categories in terms of the way we're able to experience the world, the psychological structures through which the world becomes known to us and becomes meaningful to us.
Yeah, you quote, kind of following along with that, you quote Jung, who wrote that image is the meaning itself. In this, you kind of connect with things like images and signs versus symbols, archetypes and primordial images, passive versus active imagination, and so on. Can you kind of unpack Jung's theory of like images and signs? And what does it mean to say that images themselves are the meaning of things?
Boy, that's a lot of different questions.
You can pick one and just go wherever you want to go.
Sure. So, well, starting with the idea that image has meaning in itself, Jung believes, and I agree, I think it's experientially self-evident, although many people have perhaps been educated otherwise, to think otherwise, that when an image presents itself, it presents its own meaning on a couple of different levels. And I want to be careful about this, because I'm not suggesting that an image necessarily has some sort of encoded linguistic meaning in it that's always going to be the same for everyone. That's not it. It's rather that the image itself, I mean, let's just say it contains information, if nothing else, right? If you have an image of an apple hanging from a tree and a woman reaching for it, well, there's all sorts of information encoded in that image, and it's perfectly possible to apprehend that meaning without having to use words at all, right? We have this capacity to see images in the world and make meaning of them as containing information that isn't necessarily linguistic. So one of the things Jung was trying to do was recenter our understanding of the meaning of images and allow an image that emerges from the unconscious in a dream, for example, or in a fantasy, to allow that image to be a container for its own meaning, first and foremost, without immediately trying to reduce it to a linguistic analysis. Which is, for example, that's what you see happening in the propositional imagination that you asked me about at the beginning of this conversation, where you can talk about propositional imagination, these what-if scenarios, without thinking about images at all, You don't need an image to ask, if I go to the park, you know, will I find a quarter on the ground? Maybe you think of those images, right? Maybe you imagine the quarter, maybe you don't. You can think about that in purely linguistic terms. And what Jung wanted to do was stop trying to get away from this tendency we have to reduce imaginal experience to purely linguistic experience, and rather to really attend to the image itself and all of the different kinds of meanings that can emerge from that image. Now, some of those meanings will be linguistic, right? If you look at the, say, this image I was using as an example, a apple growing from a tree, a woman reaching for it. Well, for many of us raised in Western culture, that's going to evoke the Old Testament of the Bible and Eve reaching for the forbidden fruit. And then all of the associations that we have with that whole religious tradition, both positive and negative. So all of that meaning is bursting in that image. There are a lot of different levels of meaning we can get from that image as well. There's emotional meaning, there's spiritual meaning, there's, and you know, many levels of analysis can go on, and that will start to take us into language. But Jung wanted us to be able to engage with our images as meaning containing and irreducible first and foremost, and to allow any sort of linguistic analysis or interpretation as a secondary process. So that's one small piece of what you asked me, but there was more to the question. Can you say what else was
there? Yeah. I mean, I was mostly interested in kind of the nature of images. I was maybe kind of adding a little too much, but we can move on.
It's important. It was just a lot to try to answer all at once.
Yeah, no, that's fine.
I will say also that part of why this was so important to Jung is that for Jung, he felt that image was the most direct bridge to engaging with the unconscious. If we want to engage with this vast unknown aspect of ourselves, and we go into either a reverie and start to pay attention to our fantasies, or engage in a process he called active imagination, where we're actively inviting these images to come, or whether it's in a dream, he felt that these images that emerge from the unconscious, that engaging with them and making sense with them, and even befriending them in a sense, relating to them, that this was the road to self-awareness and to basically adult psychological development. He had a process of adult psychological development he called individuation, where we become more fully ourselves by engagement with the unconscious. And for him, that proceeded largely through engagement with the images that emerge from the unconscious mind. So for Jung, image really was absolutely essential to his psychology.
Yeah, kind of picking up, you mentioned individuation, and the next person you really discuss is James Hillman. And with him, the term is soul-making, but you kind of, there seems to be kind of a lot of parallels in there. You write that Hillman took Jung's notion that images psyche to its logical conclusion, insisting on a psychology that was born out of imagination, that was expressed and understood primarily as a mythopoetic discourse. Can you kind of unpack what this means and how individuation and soul making work?
Yeah. Wow. So I can try.
Maybe just narrow it down to like in terms of images.
Yeah. Hillman is a challenging figure. And I'll tell you, the first time I read his seminal work, Revisioning Psychology, I was just baffled and kind of infuriated. The second time reading it, I was really astounded when I realized what it was he was actually trying to do and the degree to which he was really pushing back against a lot of deeply ingrained habits in Western intellectual tradition. So you can take, for example, the fact that he takes the idea of individuation and moves it over to this other language. He starts talking about it as soul making. So as I just said, individuation in Jungian framework, it's about a process of self-discovery and self-development, becoming who we truly are as individuals through engaging with the unconscious and integrating the unconscious aspects of our being. So James Hillman takes this and moves it into this new territory. He calls it soul making, which in itself is, it's a very different kind of language, right? Whereas individuation sounds very intellectual and technical, soul making is deliberately using language which is very poetic, right? It's language that wants us to imagine what the soul might be and how we might make our own souls. It takes us out of this this more reductive, analytical, technical language that psychology has been couched in really, you know, forever, and wants us to move into a way of talking about psychology, which is almost literary, right? That we talk about the psyche the way we might discuss a poem or a work of literature, because, and this is what I meant when I said that Hillman was taking Jung's idea of image as psyche to its logical conclusion. If images really are the bedrock of the unconscious mind, and if engagement with image is at the core of how we both become more fully ourselves and how we heal from our psychological wounds and so on, then shouldn't we take the whole project of psychology into a more mythopoetic place and start to engage with it in a way which is much more openly about engagement with imagination, with literature, with image, with fantasy, and stop being so damn technical about the whole thing?
Yeah, so it's kind of like a pragmatic, more spiritual approach, it seems, at least from what I'm picking up from it.
Sure. I mean, and you know, I have never been able to understand where James Hillman's beliefs lay as far as things like spirituality and religion. It's confusing. You know, at some point it seems like he's very open, to that whole world. And at other times he doesn't seem open to it at all. What he's really getting at, is it's actually a little bit more like a radicalized view of that original Aristotelian idea of imagination as this intermediary between sensation and intellect, where also you see echoes of it in Harari's idea too, that so much human experience and culture is what we've chosen to imagine together. James Hillman saying that our psyches are made of imagination, ourselves. Our world, it's all made of images. And if we can recognize that and start to engage with it on that level and stop taking it all so literally, this is something he said over and over and over again. He wanted us to stop taking everything so literally and to allow ourselves to engage with our imaginal experience, both in ourselves and in the world, with a lighter touch that allowed it to have a metaphorical and symbolic dimension to it. On a regular basis, he really felt that that was the path towards healing and wholeness, insofar as he believed wholeness was even possible, which is another conversation topic, perhaps.
Right. So this is kind of we're at a point in the book where you shift. You've been doing kind of a history of the imagination, and at this point you switch to kind of the neuroscientific stuff. So you start by talking about the binding problem and questions around multisensory processing. So can you kind of unpack what you're getting at here and what questions they raise around themes we've been talking about interpretation, mental representation, and imagination?
Yeah, I guess I should, I'd like to preface this since we're switching gears a little bit here. Part of the reason I wrote the book this way is that, as I said, I'm clearly concerned by reductionism, right? I'm concerned with a destructive reductionism that tries to take all the complex wholes of reality and hammer them down just into their individual granular pieces. And so to avoid that, in going into an examination of the neuroscience of imagination, I felt like, well, before I go there, let's start by really getting into this rich discourse on imagination in the humanities first. And to really demonstrate the breadth and complexity and richness and fullness of what imagination has meant to human beings throughout our history. And then once we've done that, then let's look and see how is neuroscience doing with tackling something that is so big and complex and rich. So I started to do that from a number of different perspectives. And one of the ways I started to look at it was just the way that mental images appear in the brain. what do we know about that? How the brain works with mental images. And the way that that gets entangled with the way the brain processes perception. The fact that, for example, if you see an apple, if you close your eyes and imagine the apple that you just saw, if you then 6 weeks later imagine a similar apple, but now it's green, well, that's actually all happening primarily in the visual cortex. When we are engaged in looking at mental images, whether they're memories, whether they are new constructions, we're engaging the brain's sensory apparatus. And using our ability to make sense of the outside world with our perception, with our senses, to recreate these new images, these new models of you know, whether it's a model of something that exists in the world, or whether we're modeling something brand new, something totally totally our own creation. We can only do that by use of these sensory modalities. So that's where I began my examination of imagination in the brain, is looking at the way that imagination and perception are really actually quite entangled on a neurological level. And so your question was about the binding problem and multisensory processing. One of the things that's quite interesting about multisensory processing is that we tend to think of our senses as being these distinct things, right? We're taught this from grade school on, at least I was. You know, you've got your five senses, maybe sometimes there's a sixth, you know, that could be any, you know. But if you actually get into the neurobiology of it, well, we have all kinds of different senses. You know, you got like your sense of touch, but the sense of touch is made up of any number of individual factors, right? Individual sense receptors. You know, the way we sense vibration, for example, is a completely different sense receptor than the way we sense heat. So there's more than five senses, first of all. But then in multisensory processing, we see that there's all of this cross-networking going on between the different sensory systems, right? There's all this cross-communication, which is fascinating. And again, you know, I don't know that we really know what to make of this or what to do with it, that the brain seems to be so holistically engaged with itself on that level. But it does bring us to the question of the binding problem. And the binding problem, which is related to the conundrum of consciousness itself and where consciousness comes from, the binding problem is asking, how is it that all of this sensory information coming into the brain and then being, you know, cross-referenced with memory and all of the other complicated things that happens, how does that actually emerge as a unified experience? How does it all actually bind together to become the whole that that we are experiencing as human beings? And that's a great question. It's something we still don't know how to answer, in the same way that we don't really know how to answer how consciousness exists in the brain, where consciousness really comes from. We can track with great precision, for example, we can see, you know, we've got light coming in through the eyes, right? And we have all these specific sense receptors within the eyes to, you know, picking up these different kinds of light, and that all fires back. We can track this. We can look at the electrical impulses moving back through the optic nerve. We see them relaying at the thalamus and then, going to the visual cortex to essentially be processed and interpreted before then feeding forward into what eventually becomes a global experience of the world that we're experiencing with our senses. But the question of how all of that becomes a unified whole, that's the binding problem. And that's a great mystery as far as I can tell. We really don't know how to answer that question.
Yeah, so kind of going along with that, you follow another neuroscientist, Stephen Coslin, who argues that the brain stores descriptions rather than images. And you connect that to the ways in which our memories help us. Memory not only exists in the past, but it actually helps us navigate and interpret our present. So how exactly does our brain function in these ways regarding interpretation? And what does it tell us about imagination's role in helping us navigate and make sense of the world?
I got a little distracted because I'm trying to think if that's a fair representation of Coslin.
You can correct me if I misunderstood something.
Well, there's been this long and frankly technical and esoteric debate about the way images work in the brain, which I don't really think is super interesting or worth getting into here. But what's sort of emerged, and this is not so much Koslin as it is more of like Koslin like engaging with trying to help create a consensus around this. What Koslin talks about is that we have information stored in a propositional manner in the brain. We have like coded information about what various facts and things, and that information then gets pulled into the sensory system. So, for example, you have information about a can of tuna fish. I don't know, all sorts of facts and things about a can of tuna fish. That information gets recruited by the visual cortex in order for us to imagine that can of tuna fish, right? So it's not actually, so the images aren't stored as images. We store data as, what is the word I'm looking for? We store information as information, not as image per se. And then the information gets turned into image in the sensory processing areas of the brain. That's what Koslin is suggesting as the basic process of mental images coming into formation. That we gather the information and then create the image out of that information in real time. And so I think you also asked about memory, right?
Kind of how it helps us navigate. Like it isn't just past events. It's something that helps us navigate the present. Can you kind of unpack how that works?
Well, sure. Memory from a... There are many different kinds of memory. When we're talking about the neuroscience of memory, we're talking about a lot of different things. And it's basically, most broadly speaking, memory from a neuroscience perspective is any sort of information that we store about the world, including information around, how to ride a bike, even if we don't, have that as a list of discrete facts. Any sort of any experience that leaves an impression that might affect our future behavior is a kind of memory, right? When we talk about memory on a more human level, we're usually talking about episodic memory specifically. And episodic memory is when we actually imagine scenes, right? Events from our lives, the sort of autobiographical story of our lives. When we get into that, we're talking about episodic memory. But memory exists on these other levels as well, whether it's just memorizing facts or procedural memory about how to do something, how to do a task, and so on and so forth. The whole point of memory from a strictly biological point of view, from a Darwinian evolutionary point of view, is to allow past experience to inform our future decisions, right? So elephants, for example, have, they have extraordinary memories in general, but one thing they're known for is the fact that they know where all the water holes are, right? All across vast areas. And obviously you can see the evolutionary adaptability in that. If you know exactly where every waterhole is over hundreds and hundreds of miles, you're more likely to lead your family of elephants to water in times of drought. So that's given that that's the basic biological purpose of memory. Again, I'm speaking in strictly evolutionary biological terms here. It makes a lot of sense then that the ways that memory affects us on a more cultural and individual level is going to follow that basic model. What this means for us, though, is that the way we experience the world in our perception, as I said earlier, there's this real entanglement that happens around perception and imagination because we use the same architecture for both. And we also use the same architecture for memory. If you have memories of specific images, if you have memories of things that you've heard, they'll be associated with those sensory areas. And so the process of remembering, perceiving, and imagining are much more closely related to each other in the brain than is maybe comfortable for most of us to think about. And so for that reason, when we have, for example, you can see pretty extreme examples of it in PTSD, for example. where someone has had a very traumatic experience, and then something in present time triggers them. Maybe it's a loud noise or a scary looking man or something. And there's nothing actually threatening happening in the moment. But because of the intensity of the memory and the way memory is entangled with imagination and perception, simply having that sensory stimulus of the loud noise or this or the, you know, let's not even call him scary, maybe he's just a tall man, right, with a dark beard. And that's terrifying if you had a traumatic experience with someone who looks like that, or with a dog, right? People who've had bad experiences with dogs may be terrified of perfectly friendly, lovable dogs who just want to say hello. And in this case, what we're seeing is that the memory of what's happened is almost being re-experienced in present time. This is a really extreme example, but it goes to show the degree to which part of what makes us human and part of what I think we have to contend with as humans is the degree to which our past experiences can shape our present perceptions. And if we're not careful and discerning and thinking critically, it's very easy for us to simply fall into patterns of seeing what we expect to see based on past experience and not being able to experience new things, new possibilities, new avenues of life, new avenues of self-development, and so on.
Yeah, so next you actually bring back Hillman for a bit. You talk about his theory of anima mundi, and you connect it to personification, identifying with narratives, and you talk about how this can help us heal mentally and emotionally from trauma. You talked just now about PTSD, so can you kind of unpack what anima mundi is and how this personification kind of can help us heal or individuate?
Yeah, and this is stepping back a little bit to the previous discussion. I'll explain what it is, and I'll try to explain why I started talking about it in the neuroscience section. So, first of all, anima mundi actually comes from the ancient Greeks. It comes from Neoplatonic thought, which is it was a expansion of Platonic philosophy that really put image at the center of the whole universe, right? That the whole universe was an emanation of divine images coming from the divine, essentially. And so the anima mundi was the animate world. It was the world that was the living animate expression of images emanating from the divine mind, essentially. And so Hillman takes this idea, and now it's important to remember that Hillman is now using it not metaphysically, but psychologically. But what Hillman is suggesting we do is allow for ourselves to imagine the world that way, which is a little different from saying it is metaphysically so. I think that's an important distinction to make. Rather, it's saying that if we can allow the world to become animate and alive with divine images, it restores a level of meaning and enchantment to the world and in our everyday experience. All of a sudden, as we go through our days, we're not just seeing the flat, dead world of material reality. We're seeing a living psychic landscape that is bursting with meaning if we're willing to engage with it on that level. And that's really what he was advocating for. He was advocating for a real awakening of the imagination as a way of reinfusing the world with meaning. And again, this is, I do think it's an important distinction that this isn't necessarily a metaphysical move as much as a psychological one. It's a way of engaging with the world on a different level that allows it to become more alive, essentially. That's my understanding of what James Hillman was doing and talking about the anima mundi or the world soul and why we should return to it. The reason I started talking about it at the end of the chapter on the neuroscience of perception and mental images is that to some extent, we are all living inside of an imaginal reality. Our brains are taking in all of the sensory data, cross-referencing it with memory, and then putting together an experience for us that is based on the material world outside. Obviously, if it wasn't, we'd be in a lot of trouble. We wouldn't survive long, but is also totally integrated with and entangled with our sense of psychological meanings and our cultural meanings. We're all inside of that. It's this idea that we are actually inside of our own souls, experiencing our own interiority, even as we move through the world. Something we don't often think about. We tend to take everything around us totally literally. And this is what Hillman was getting at when he said, stop taking everything you experience so literally. What if you take a step back? What if your experience of the world was a succession of meaningful images rather than always being a series of literal truths? What changes? And Hillman believed that this was a profoundly healing move for us to be able to re-engage with all the possibility and potential for psychological meaning in our day-to-day existence that we've become somewhat alienated from in moving into a much more materialistic, rationalistic worldview. So I bring that up in this chapter simply because I feel that there's a neurological basis for suggesting that this is indeed the case, that what we are experiencing from a brain perspective is a world that is partially constructed based on imagination, based on memory.
Yeah, so you move kind of following along those lines. You start talking about creativity. You write about it as having a sort of backstage process where your brain is kind of working out an idea, often during a time you refer to as DMN or default mode network. What is DMN and how does it help us with creative problem solving?
So the discourse on the default mode network is not finished by any means. And it's been interpreted a couple of different ways. What it is essentially is the default mode network is the network of regions of the brain that go online when we're not externally focused on a task. So when we're moving into a state of daydreaming or reverie, there's this particular network that goes online, and it seems like the brain is starting to have a conversation with itself. For these aspects of the brain are starting to have a conversation with each other in this inner space that is not externally focused, which is it's a completely separate or largely separate network from the executive network, which is the network that comes online when we are task focused and doing something in the external world. And then there's a salience network that its job is to sort of balance between these two. How much do we have an inward focus? How much do we have an external task oriented focus? So it's been posited. Some folks have gone so far as to say that the default mode network is the imagination network, or you know that it's absolutely essential to creativity because it's where we go to kind of play with possibilities and turn ideas over and whatnot. Now there's not consensus around that, but daydreaming is part of what happens in the default mode network. So then, if we move the conversation over to creativity, well, creativity. Part of what's important about creativity on a neurobiological level is making new connections. We make new connections between ideas, new connections between possibilities. When we're thinking outside the box, right? That's the phrase we use to talk about a big creative idea. It's like we've gotten outside of the associations that we have around a particular problem and are suddenly able to make a new series of connections. So that association, that process of connecting new ideas, new possibilities, allowing that to emerge as a new road forward. That's one of the things that can help. That is a process of daydreaming, a process of simply allowing ideas to engage and interact with one another, and then allowing something new to emerge. And part of what this entails is that we're not always necessarily completely in control of that part of the process. We can be working on a problem consciously, rationally, trying to solve it for quite some time using the limited scope of our working memory to deal with the problem as we understand it. But at some point, if we can't find a solution, there's great benefit in being able to let go and allow the mind to move into a more associative space where new connections can be made. And that is that's where the default mode network is seen as being potentially quite important to the creative process.
Yeah, so you kind of distinguish a couple different forms of creativity, because not all creativity is about just problem solving. Some of it, you talk about how it is about generating imaginal holes. What exactly is an imaginal hole, and what does it tell us about imagination and creativity?
Yeah, so I studied literature as an undergraduate and ended up writing I did a second major in interdisciplinary studies and wrote my undergraduate thesis on creativity. And creativity has just, it's something that it's just been really important to me on both personally and professionally, and something that's fascinating and inspiring to me. And so as I started to engage with the way neuroscience talks about creativity, I was very curious to see how they talked about it, how much it was going to get reduced. And of course, it was going to have to get reduced some, because that's, you know, you've got to be able to reduce a phenomenon sufficiently to study it in a way that counts as scientific. You know, you've got to actually be able to look at discrete phenomena that are measurable. So when I start to talk about imaginal holes in the book, here's what I'm getting at. It's that so much of the neuroscience of creativity is looking at a more, a simpler kind of process, like making new associations. There's a variety of theories about how new associations get made that might lead to a new idea or a new solution to a problem. Or, you know, even if in the arts, maybe you get a new idea for what you want to paint, or maybe a new solution to the direction the plot of your book should go. Fair, right? And that's all important research, and there's some very compelling theories and compelling evidence in that space. But it still doesn't quite get at the fullness and richness and complexity of the creative experience as experienced by creative artists, for example. And, you know, there have also been some moments in the history of science where there's just been like a wow, lightning strikes, something just emerges in the mind of a scientist, and they have a whole new conception of the field that they're working in. And that is something that neuroscience hasn't really been able to address in quite the same way. It's a lot harder to understand where that comes from. This is where we get back to this idea of the emergent properties of brains. When all the little pieces are interacting together in this sort of unimaginable complexity, and then from it, something new emerges that you couldn't have predicted, right? So artists will talk about, writers will talk about, and this is something I've experienced myself, you get into a flow state where something just seems to be coming through with a whole paragraphs emerging at a time, or a whole rich, complex vision, for a work of art, or the experience of moving so deeply into the process of writing a novel or a screenplay that it really starts to feel like you're there, and that you're not really controlling the characters so much as just kind of listening in on their conversations. That kind of creativity, that level of immersion in the emergence of something that feels so rich and full, is harder to explain on a neurobiological level. And I think it's important that we honor that is something that artists experience. And not just that it's something that artists experience, but that it's one of the principal reasons artists make art, because it feels for many of us deeply meaningful to engage in a creative process where our ego kind of moves to the side, and we're participating in the creation of something new rather than simply tinkering away at the solution to a problem.
Yeah, so kind of wrapping things up, one of the things I found really interesting in your kind of more synthetic approach between humanities and neuroscience is how you see science and culture influencing each other in theories of the imagination. So a passage you quote in your book reads, "The water technology of antiquity underlies the Greek concept of the soul. The clockwork mechanisms proliferating during the Enlightenment are ticking with seminal influence inside Le Maître's L'Homme machine. Victorian pressurized steam engines and hydraulic machines are churning underneath Freud's hydraulic construction of the unconscious and its libidinal economy. The arrival of the telegraph network provided by Helmholtz with his basic neural metaphor, as did reverberating relay circuits and solenoids for Hebb's theory of memory and so on." So kind of looking at this passage, how does this history of parallels between science and broader culture help us think more critically and more deeply about science in general, and more specifically contemporary neuroscience around the imagination?
So in that particular section where I quote that passage, which I just love that. It's such a great window into the way our understanding of the world shapes, you know, the way we investigate things. I was looking at the way we've created images and metaphors essentially as models for the mind, models for the brain as time has gone on. And that what I'm getting at, first of all, to recognize that our understanding of the brain, our understanding of the mind has evolved over time, that we've had these different images that have seemed right to us, these different metaphorical models that have seemed right to us to a point, but they're always getting replaced as we get new information. And part of the fascination of this is to see how each one of these models, as I said earlier on in the conversation, each one of these models is useful to a point, right? We can recognize some aspects of each of these models as being useful. You know, the computer model, which is still, quite popular, covers a lot of ground in terms of what our brains do and what our minds do. But does it cover everything? Well, not if we're going to take complexity science seriously. And if we take complexity science seriously, well, then what's happening is, I think this is also a quote in the book, that what's happening in the brain is more akin to what happens in a hurricane or a star than what happens in a computer, or certainly at least that there's a star-like quality to our brains and to our minds, in the same way that there's a computer-like quality or a computer-like aspect to our brains and minds and what they do. So part of looking at this history and seeing the evolution is, first of all, just be willing to have a little bit of humility around the fact that probably there will be more models, right? We don't necessarily have it completely nailed down. And that's okay, that we are doing our best with the resources available to us, not just the scientific resources, but also the cultural resources that we use to make meaning of science. And that undergirds science in some ways, that, you know, the things we choose to study, the things we choose to research in science are going to be driven by cultural factors as well. And that just means we're human. I feel like I've got to be very careful about this because I really love science. I think science is so important, and it's something that really needs to be honored and respected. And also, honoring and respecting something doesn't mean that we just let it have total and complete authority over us when it itself may have some important limitations, which we should keep in mind. So I wish we were able to have a conversation about this without it becoming so polarized. You know, as soon as I start to criticize point out the limitations of science, and or that science is influenced by cultural factors, I immediately feel like I'm going to get pigeonholed into a lot of the anti-scientific sentiment that we are unfortunately seeing in our world. You know, for example, the the current denial of climate science, which frankly is, I just think it's tragic and terrifying that we're not respecting what a great consensus of scientists are telling us about something that's so important. And as much as I feel that way, I think both things are true. I think that we must respect our climate scientists and take them seriously, and scientists in general. And we can also recognize that science is a human activity. There are human factors that influence it. There are cultural factors that influence it. And we should be mindful about that. And I think doing so will actually make our science better, not worse. But as you can tell, I feel like I got to tread very carefully when it comes to this particular topic.
Yeah, so that is great. That kind of brings us to the end of the book. So kind of as a final question, what, if anything, are you working on now?
Well, I'm someone with diverse interests, so I'm working on all sorts of different things. I'm not working on another academic book at the moment. I think the two things I'm most interested in pursuing in terms of academic research and writing, really interested in the way human beings deal with complexity and the way that we certainly seem to have a lot of evidence that the world is incredibly complex on many different levels. And yet we still have this impulse to default towards reductionistic stories on many different levels. So I'd love to really get into that and write a book about that at some point in the next few years. I'm also really deeply interested in human relationships with animals, and in particular, human relationships with other intelligent species, species that seem to have complex elements of culture. You know, elephants, for example, the great apes. Dolphins and cetaceans. I'm really interested in the way that human beings engage with these other intelligent species and the way we've tried to communicate with them and tried to understand them and how that process has evolved. So that's another research area that I hope to write about in the years to come. In the meantime, I'm actually writing a good bit of science fiction. I have a couple of science fiction books I published this year, and I've got a collection of short stories published last year. Got a collection of short stories coming out this year, and more of that to come, hopefully. So that's a totally different topic. But I think anyone who's familiar with my academic work will see elements of it emerging in the science fiction as well. And that's a way where I get to a place where I get to walk my talk a little bit about the work of imagination and the importance of it, and the way imagination allows us to imagine ourselves, to examine and experience new possibilities for who we are and what we might be.
Yeah, you seem to really love to kind of move around and try different things. So, Jonathan Erickson, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.